Hello, I'm Mark DeLuzio. Over the past century, our constitutional republic, grounded in the rule of law, has been transformed into a tyrannical democracy, orchestrated by unelected bureaucrats and globalists. The Constitution is now treated as a suggestion, not the law of the land. Welcome to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God.
Hi, I'm Mark's co-host, Suzette Lawrence. Our intention is to explore the Constitution and discuss how our freedoms and constitutional rights are violated by those very politicians who took an oath on the Bible to uphold it. Learn how the Constitution is the solution to our country's problems. What do we need to do to restore our inalienable and enumerated rights? Class begins now.
Episode 35, Mark DeLuzio, Suzette Lawrence, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And I understand that you're going to be talking today about an old friend of mine, a guy named Thomas Jefferson.
I am. And, you know, it's interesting because I thought I knew a fair amount about him. I've been to Monticello, and which, you know, big whoop, but it's still nice. You know, it's still there. And you see like how small it is and all the photographs, it looks gargantuan, right? But when you get there, it wasn't really that big. But the house, I mean, but it, you know, I learned so much about Thomas Jefferson in this last few days. And I've been listening to the perspective of Americans, the perspective of people from Monticello, the curator there, or the director at Monticello. And then I listened to an Englishman, an English historian, and I realized there's so many facets to him that I kind of separated it into his family life, his education, which was very, very important to him, and then his life as a statesman. You know, how he essentially served our country and this idea of a constitutional republic. So today I want to talk about his family life and a little bit about his education, because I think that's really important. And then we'll come back and talk about, do a deep dive into some of the his actions as a statesman, because there's so many. I mean, we couldn't get it all if we sat here all morning. So
he's one of those guys that you need five episodes to really do, just scratch the surface. Well, you know, I did know him. I told you that. He allowed me to call him TJ, but that was only when we were by ourselves, like in a pub or something. So, you know, I wasn't able to do that in public, of course, you know. But anyway, I find him to be one of the most fascinating men in our history. And I've said on Elsa Kurtz's podcast that, you know, if I were to meet three people, it would be Thomas Jefferson. I'd love to meet and sit down with Margaret Thatcher. And of course, my number one would be Jesus Christ. But there's others too. Like, we're going to be doing Ben Franklin next. And he is amazing as well. All these guys were amazing. And I get sick and tired of hearing them called, oh, they were just old white men. And they were slave owners, and knowing that, and we've talked about this before, all of these men who signed the Declaration signed a death warrant that would have resulted, if we lost a Revolutionary War, not in their quick death, but a very torturous death. And people don't know that. People don't understand that, what those men did for us. And they were all pretty much of wealth, so they didn't need to do it, kind of like Donald Trump. He didn't need to do it.
No.
Okay.
But
they thought more about the country and put themselves, you know, second in that regard, or maybe even third. And I just get sick and tired. So why are we spending time on these founding fathers? And we'll do others as well. There's Hamilton, there's Adams, there's John Jay, there's Madison, Monroe. Oh my God, there's a bunch of them that we need to talk about. But why are we doing that? We need to educate people about the brilliance that they are benefactors of today. And that's what really gets me when they kind of diss these guys away. Because let me tell you something. Most of the people that have told me that, you know, well, they were old white men. A, they weren't old. Okay. During the 20s and 30s, I think Jefferson was, what, 33 when he did the Declaration, signed the Declaration?
Yes.
Anyway, they wouldn't have the guts to do what they did. Most of the people that I know who talk like that would not have the guts. And by the way, they would have owned slaves. Okay. So anyway, I'm going to turn it over to you, Suzette. You can call him TJ if you want, but he was a fascinating individual. So go ahead.
So Thomas Jefferson was born on April 13th, 1743 at his family's Shadwell, Virginia plantation. Now, it was a 3,000-acre plantation, and they planted tobacco. And it was east, so it was in a place called the Piedmont, east of the Blue Ridge Mountains in Albemarle, Virginia. Now, this was like great land, great water access. I mean, really prima. And it was had been awarded to his family by the King of England 100 years before in 1612. So they were literally one of the first families of Virginia. During this time, tobacco was everything. You could settle debts with tobacco. You could pay fines with tobacco. It was the primary economic engine of Virginia, and it would not have been possible without slavery, which is heartbreaking. So slaves were the major workforce. Now, there were free people that worked on the plantation as well, but over his lifetime, Jefferson would own over 600 slaves. They came to him through inheritance. When he inherited Shadwell, 68 slaves came with it. And we're going to spend some time on this because this is a really important issue for all of us to understand, you know, what the circumstances of the time were and how, as a statesman, you're not a despot. So a despot, one guy pretending to be king could make a declaration and it would be so. But in a constitutional republic, the one we were trying, that he so desperately was working to create, you had to have consensus. And there just wasn't consensus. People were not unwilling to give up their livelihood to free people that they were concerned might not survive. You know, the problem being there was such, like, if you were Black and you couldn't just walk around, you couldn't just get on the train and go north, you know, you would risk either being apprehended and enslaved by the first white guy that could stop you, or you'd be lynched or killed. You know, typically these people were not lynched and killed because they were so valuable workers. So, you know, if you could sequester a runaway slave, you could claim them and own them. So, you know, the idea of dissolving slavery, it had to be done gradually and very thoughtfully, you know. So one of the things, so I just want to bring that up, because with Jefferson, you always hear about that, you know, the difference between what he believed and how he actually lived, you know, and there was a gap there. And so I got into trying to understand why that gap existed, and I'll be sharing that. So,
by the way, Suzette, when I've studied him and other founders like Ben Franklin, for example, which we're going to talk about next, they had a lot of wisdom when they put this country together, which is really maybe one episode. We should just talk about the wisdom. But one of the things they said, they all agreed to, Franklin, for example, knew slavery was wrong. He wrote about it. But they all said, and they fought about it, because there are some people who put our founding documents together that were still for it. But they knew that if they fought that battle, then they would never have a country.
Oh, there was no question about it. There was no, that wasn't going to happen. There was never going to be a break from King George if we couldn't be united. And when you are working with other people, you have to gain consensus. We all know this in business. You're not always going to get everything your way, but you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, you work hard. That's why being able to make a deal is such a powerful thing, because everybody has, my brother-in-law used to say, leave a little for the other guy. You know, when you're making a deal, like don't try to squeeze every last dime out of them, you know, like be conciliatory. So Thomas Jefferson, again, born in 1743 in April, he was the third child of Peter and Jane Randolph. Jane's family was also a first family of Virginia, one of the wealthiest. I think her father had 11 plantations and 9 children that lived, which was very unusual. You know, in Thomas Jefferson's case, they had, I've heard 8 and I've heard 10 children mm-hmm. in that family. But 8 of the 6, he had 6 daughters. Peter and Jane had 6 daughters and 2 sons, and Thomas Jefferson was the eldest son. So only 6 of those children lived to adulthood. Mm-hmm. And Peter and Jane were married in 1739. And let's see. Peter was self-educated. He was a surveyor. He was a colonel in the Virginia militia.
I just want to make sure I understand. Peter was who again? His brother?
Peter Jefferson was Thomas's father.
Oh, his father. I'm sorry. Okay, got it.
And his father was self-educated. He always wanted to be formally educated, but he had to rely on himself. And he, so he was a surveyor. He was a planter, of course. Mm-hmm. And he was a colonel in the Virginia militia. Now, I bring this up because he made a promise to that all of his children would be educated, and they all were. The girls read, they played music, they read the classics. I mean, he wasn't sexist about educating his children, you know, and of course he was self-educated, as a lot of people were. So let's see, Peter, you know, the thing that he taught his son, Thomas, was to ride and shoot. You know, everybody had to be able to ride and shoot. And this is something that stayed with him throughout his life. He rode every day. He exercised every day. He was really a very, very disciplined human. So he was, again, Peter was self-educated, and he died at the age of 57, which was pretty average back then. People tended to die quickly, and nobody was, you weren't always sure why. You know, sometimes they didn't have a long illness, you know, but he passed away when he was young. And at that point, Thomas was 9. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he went to, I'm getting ahead of myself. So while his father was still living, he sends him at the age of 9 to live with Reverend William Douglas, who taught him basic French, Latin, and Greek. This was kind of the beginning of what being educated during that time meant. You had to read the classics. You had to understand French. You had to understand, obviously, English. You had to understand Latin and be able to read Latin, because some the classics were all written in that and in Greek. And so he went to live with Reverend Douglas and learned that. And later he studied. So when he finished that, he came home and his father sends him back out to live with Reverend James Morey, and who was a renowned classicist. He was like the best guy in that area. And Virginia was the most populated of the colonies, a very powerful, large, wealthy colony. So it attracted a lot of really good people.
I never knew that, by the way. I never knew it was the largest. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Great. It was very powerful, you know, had a mm-hmm, lot of mm-hmm. waterfront, lot of great land, clean, mm-hmm. good land for growing. Mm-hmm. And so so Reverend Morey introduced him to the classical literature, history, and philosophy. you know, of the ancient Greeks and Romans. So this was, now there's a lot going on at this point, you know, but he's setting that foundational understanding to understand what has happened before, because history really does, somebody said history may not repeat, but it rhymes. You know, there's nothing really new on the scene. There just isn't. So, and they understood that. So, and he successfully, when he finished there, his father had passed away. He was 14 years old, and he was now the owner of Shadwell. He owned the plantation, and his mother, Jane, ran it. You know, she was kind of responsible. And I guess there were executors there as well that were helping to manage everything. But she essentially was in charge, and he petitioned his executors to send him to William and Mary. He wanted to go. That was the school in Virginia, and he wanted to go there. And they, of course, sent him, and he studied there. He was there, let's see, he studied science. So this is the cool thing about this. So he's 14 years old. He goes to William and Mary. He called his tutors there the Williamsburg Trio. Okay. That's how he referred to them. And they educated him. And they also played the role of the father figure. They gave him like really good, they were really great role models, which was one of the reasons that people used to send their kids off, because they wanted their children to be able to model themselves after people that they respected. And so he goes to William and Mary, and a man by the name of Dr. William Small, a Scotsman, teaches him science. His law mentor is George Wythe. He was the most accomplished lawyer in Virginia at that time. And his third mentor was none less than the royal governor at that time, Francis Fouquier. So he introduced him to society, the arts, and music. So he's at William and Mary. He's studying. And Dr. Small introduces him to the Enlightenment. So these are the Enlightenment, for those of you that aren't totally clear on that, up until, so long as we had a monarchy, the monarchs all would use the phrase, what we would describe as the royal we. So the royal we was, Jesus and I were talking about this, and not the way that you and I might pray to him or listen for his answer. They felt on equal footing with Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. So this is really heresy. I mean, you can appreciate that these people were delusional. And what the Enlightenment brought to the picture was the voice of reason, that without a spiritual component, a human being, a man, could reason and make good decisions for himself. Be reasonable, not just, it wasn't good enough to be right. It had to be reasonable. You know, you didn't just barrel ahead because you're right. You had to do things with reason. And that's what the Age of Enlightenment was. It separated spiritual life from a reasonable solution to whatever you were dealing with. So this was what the conversation was about. Now, for the first time, he's in Williamsburg. This is where William and Mary is at Williamsburg. And mm-hmm. That was the capital city. I believe that was it was a city of 1,000 people. And yes, it was the capital. That's where the royal governor Fouquier's palace was. And his mentors managed to get him invited to these dinners. They were, you know, once a week, the governor would have like the top guys, think Knickerbocker Club, and they would sit around and they would network and they would discuss these things. They would discuss politics. They would discuss religion. They would discuss philosophy. They would discuss history. They would discuss the relationship between the colonies and London was supposed to be, the king. You know, how are we supposed to behave so that we don't get on his bad side was kind of how it was. And there was this young Thomas Jefferson, the youngest person often in the room. That's where he met Patrick Henry, actually. It was at William and Mary. Patrick Henry was also an attorney. And he, in that environment, decided that he wanted to pursue the law. And he went home. Oh, this is a fun part. So he would be at these Friday night dinners, right? And there was no entertainment, but he loved music. That was his primary passion in life, was music and books. He was a great violinist. So he would play, he would serenade these people. They all loved him. He was a great violinist. And he, I think he also played, I'm not sure if it was him. He played the harpsichord. He may have, but Patsy definitely, his wife, the woman he would later marry, played the harpsichord and sang, and she played the violin. So they were very simpatico in that they both loved music. So he is at William and Mary, and he says of Dr. Small, "He fixed the destiny of my life. Dr. Small introduced me to the philosophies of the Enlightenment, including Sir Francis Bacon, Sir Isaac Newton, and John Locke." And just to give you guys an idea of what that, what he was talking about, for those of you that were unfamiliar with this, we've all heard about the Enlightenment, but we aren't really sure what it was. John Locke nutshelled it by saying, "No one ought to hurt another, his life, his health, his liberty, or his possessions." Now, for those of you that believe that our founding documents are outdated, this is what they're based on. And I believe these to be timeless philosophies of humanity. There's no time limit. There's never a time when it's okay to hurt someone else, to hurt their health, to take their stuff. You know, I mean, so this is really what he loved. And he, you know, he understood this. He decided he would study the law. His mentor, Mr. Wythe, who is the top lawyer, sends him back to Shadwell to study. This is what his day looked like. Okay. Are you guys ready for this? He was up, he studied 15 hours a day, okay, to prepare for law school. He was up at 5 a.m. He read until 8 on books on agriculture, botany, zoology, chemistry, anatomy, and religion. From 8 to 12, he read the law. From 12 to 1, he read politics. In the afternoon, he read history. Then he ran at least a mile into the country and back. So he exercised for 2 hours every day when he was young. In the evening, he read rhetoric, oratory, literature, and language. So Dr. Small definitely approved of this. And let's see, I have notes here. This all isn't committed to memory yet. Let's see. So then Dr. Small definitely approved and saw to it that he was a frequent guest, of course, at the governor's mansion. We talked about that. At these dinners, we talked about that already, so I don't want to repeat myself. So in 1769, at the age of 26, he had finished law school. He and his fellow owners in Albemarle County elected him to the House of Burgesses. Jefferson was admitted to the bar when he was 27, and he had a great reputation of being a fair and compassionate lawyer. But I want to talk about the House of Burgesses for a minute, because it's an important component to our history. Okay, so the House of Burgesses was the first elected a legislative body in British North America and the lawmaking body of colonial Virginia. So this was the extension of the crown in the New World, in British North America. And this governor, Francis Fauquier, was the governor. So it was first established in 1619 in Jamestown. That's the first Burgesses. And each county in Virginia had two representatives to the House. Sound familiar? Known as the Burgesses, and towns could petition to send one representative. So if you felt like you deserved a representative, you could petition the House of Burgesses and they would consider you. The House of Burgesses established the colony's basic laws and evaluated petitions from the public. The House's power waxed and waned based on the political situation in England. Famous members were George Washington, George Wythe, Thomas Jefferson, and Patrick Henry. And the significance of the Burgesses was to stand against the Stamp Act, which was one of the first events that led to the Revolutionary War. So Jefferson is elected to the House of Burgesses. His father had been there. I mean, all of the big landowners at one point or another went to represent their county. And he was Albemarle County. He first proposed, so he aligned himself with these members that were vocal about resisting control of the British Parliament. So they did not want to be controlled by Britain. They wanted to be independent. And he first proposed his first legislation that he was pr proposed in the House of Burgesses, and this he's 27 years old. Was to abolish slavery. He thought that slavery was wrong. And even though it was legal in British North America, he understood that he had little hope of abolishing it because it was the economic engine. Imagine if you could have 3,000 acres of something and have people come in and work your land for next to nothing, you know, for the cost of them. Does any of this sound familiar? You know, people that
Yeah.
were unrepresented, they had no hope of being represented because they were typically black. They couldn't escape without fear of their life. This is what made Harriet Tubman such an American hero, was she did, you know, she was always trying to, she was bringing people north at the risk of her life. And she was, well, anyway, well, we can talk about her another time, but these were very powerful, like liberty-loving people, you know. So he wants to abolish slavery. He says, you know, he understood that he had little hope of abolishing it outright, but hoped at least he could reduce the number of people held in bondage. So he believed that all men were born free in nature. Yet slave labor fueled the Virginia's economy. So there's a problem there, right? There's a disconnect. His first bill gave slave owners a limited right to free individual slaves. So it would be things like one of the things that he thought was that anyone that could pass as white, because there was so many women that were subjected to the sexual desires of their owners. The black women couldn't like resist this. That there were a lot of like mulattoes or what people would call like passable black people that looked white. So, you know, they had like in the case of Sally Hemings and her family, like a lot of these kids are, you know, have red hair. They were fair-skinned
Okay,
and
now
freckled.
Sally Hemings, just help us out with Sally Hemings.
Oh, Sally Hemings was a slave at Thomas Jefferson's wife's, and I'll talk about her more. Sally Hemings was the slave to Patsy Jefferson, Thomas's wife. So her name was, her given name was Martha Wales, Skettle, I believe. And she when she came to when she married him, she brought her this 9-year-old girl who looked just like her. And everybody knew this was her half sister because her father, Patsy's dad, had like 10 kids with this one woman. So As a new member of the House of Burgesses, Jefferson, the first piece of legislation, and he got somebody else to introduce it for him because he was so young and new, was to abolish slavery. He had this idea of gradual emancipation. He knew that if a Black person were just to walk off a plantation, even if they were freed, and even if they had a skill, that the chances of their survival was slim. They would either be recaptured and someone else would enslave them, or they would be killed, you know, and the chances of them having to be able to have any kind of success, it's like throwing a drown, you know, throwing somebody that doesn't know how to swim into the pool, you know, and hoping for the best. So he introduced this legislation and it was shouted down. The people went nuts. They thought he was crazy. What was he trying? He was an enemy of the crown. Why was he trying to destroy Virginia? Didn't he understand how things were? So this is kind of, now he's 27, but this is in his mind, because he's been reading Voltaire and John Locke and these enlightened people. And he's also studying the law and reading the ancient Greeks and Latin. He understands that people are born free. And he knew these people. You know, these were not strangers to him. He understood we were all of the same species, you know, even though some people like to pretend like we weren't.
So, you know what's interesting about this? Okay.
What? There's a lot. It's amazing.
Well, you know, people, if you ask your average person on the street, oh, that's a scary thought. Well, let's just say that's what you do. and you say, why did we fight the Civil War? Or why did the Civil War happen, which happened well after his death, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because I believe he died in 1826. So, you know, another 25, 40, 30 years later, Jefferson is gone, but we fought this Civil War. Okay. They would say, oh, we fought it over racism and slavery. And in a way, you could say it was slavery. However, it was about economics. Okay, because you mentioned earlier how, you know, free labor, right? And and all that.
Thank you.
So the Civil War was about economics, and it was about racism. Like, they hated Blacks and all that. We had Black slave owners in this country, and we weren't the one that invented slavery. I mean, slavery happened, was going on for centuries. And as a matter of fact, in Africa, and Thomas Sowell talks about this, who, by the way, is a Black man, how Blacks sold Blacks into slavery in Africa. And then we had slave owners in the colonies that owned slaves. And when you tell that to somebody, they think you're a big conspiracy theorist and you were wrong. So anyway, I just want to bring that back, because I think what Jefferson got into there was like Donald Trump, who's fighting globalism, he was tapping into people's little piggy bank, and they didn't like that. And that's what that was all about, I think. That's my opinion anyway.
Well, I believe you're right, because slavery was legal in all of the colonies.
Yep.
There were fewer slaves in the North because they tended to be house slaves. But in the sense, and you know, a lot of people had indentured servants, you know, some, if you didn't have money, you could come over on a boat and somebody would, you'd have to work for nothing for 7 years. That was the term of the,
right.
your indentured servitude to someone. Mm-hmm. But slaves were, you know, in the South, they were working in the field and working hard, and it was really a miserable life. And he, so he knows this is wrong, and he makes an attempt to introduce an idea that says we should gradually emancipate the slaves. We should stop importing them. Okay, that's number one. Any babies that are born in this country by a slave should be free. So they're not just automatically slaves because their parents were. All babies should be free. And at some point, to be determined, the existing slave should be released. And he thought that if you were, he thought it would be very difficult for Black people to integrate with white people because the white people were terrified of the retribution that might come because not everybody was a nice guy.
By the way, when I talk about Franklin, who was older than Jefferson, when I get into that in the next episode, he was an abolitionist. He was also against slavery, even though he owned slaves. Okay. And he fought for them. He fought for their rights. But I wanted to say one other thing, Suzette, and it's a little bit off topic here, but
that's okay.
And we should probably do a whole episode, at least one, on slavery itself. But when you start looking at the names that you get called when you don't agree, like you're a climate denier, okay, or you're a whatever phobe they want to call you when you're against some crazy thing like abortion or whatever, you get called all these names. Well, the name carpetbagger, like when I ran for Congress, I had a place in my district. I had a home in my district, and I also, my primary residence was out of the district. Now, the Constitution doesn't say that you have to live in the congressional district that you serve. You have to live in the state, but not in the district. So people say, oh, you're a carpetbagger because you live in Scottsdale. You don't live up in District 2. And the word carpetbagger was one of those shameful names that the South gave people from the North who were abolitionists. And the reason they moved down to the South was to populate Congress so that the Southern congressional candidates could not vote back in slavery. What they called them were carpetbaggers, because that's how they travel, right? And so the whole notion, if you ask your average person, what does carpetbagger really mean? What's the origin of that? These were people from the North going down to the South to make sure that they can get a stronghold in Congress down there. And yeah, they came from the North. They weren't from there. Oh, you're a carpetbagger. You see how that works? Nothing's changed. The whole tactics are still the same. Okay. And I thought I'd throw that in as a little bit of a thought there, because it's just incredible that the more things change, the more things stay the same. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. There are a lot of wisdoms in our founding documents, and a lot of that came from Jefferson. We had some really great minds. Mm-hmm. So slavery is legal in all the states. He thinks it shouldn't be. He thinks there's a way to solve the problem reasonably, that it didn't have to like mean the destruction of anyone. Mm-hmm. And what he did on his plantation was any of the slaves that could pass as white, because there was so much intermingling between Black mm-hmm. women and white men, that some of the children could pass as white, and he would have them educated in a skill, and then they would be released. So he did some of the slaves that were on his plantation were able to go free. But he had to be very careful because he didn't want them to be nabbed by the guy down the road. So you see, that's a really, so are you really doing your dog a favor when you live in an area like I do, where there are coyotes and lynxes running around in my yard and my dog wants to go out? Do I really want to let my dog out? No, I don't. I want to keep him in.
So at that point, is just totally lost today on people. It's totally
lost. They don't
lost.
Understand how violent it was. It would be like if you got dropped into the middle of Gaza today because you wanted to volunteer with the Red Cross.
Yeah, I'd love to see all these Palestinian protesters, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas protesters go to Gaza and protest. You see how fast that lasts.
Anyway, yeah, so so it's okay. So this is kind of a little out of the timeline, but I wanted to say this because I think it's so cool. So he wrote this legislation when he was new in the House of Burgesses, mm-hmm. and 11 years later, in 1780, Philadelphia Pennsylvania was the first state to pass an act for the gradual abolition of slavery. So they picked up on this. He was a great writer. Everybody was reading his stuff. You know, there were pamphlets and his stuff went around. He had a great reputation. And that meant they were going to stop the importation of slaves into the states, require all slaves to be registered, and establish that all children born in that state were free regardless of race or parentage. While individuals who were slaves before 1780 remained in slavery, the act was the first act abolishing slavery in a democratic society.
Wait a minute. I don't ever hear any liberal talk about that, getting taught that in school.
1780, baby.
I never
this
heard
was a
anybody.
Big issue.
Well, wait a minute. You mean to tell me that we're not teaching the accurate perspective on history? I mean, I never heard
anybody. Do
they
teach history anymore? No, I shouldn't say.
Well, you know, we were taught that Stalin was our ally and he killed 100 million people, but we didn't get that one either. They kind of missed that one. And I must have been in the footnotes, right? But it's amazing how, when you start really digging into who these guys were and how virtuous they were, and by the way, they were imperfect people too, okay? Ben Franklin was a ladies' man, okay? But, you know, you start looking at this and you start saying, why isn't this stuff taught in school? Because we have to, you know, what's Kamala saying? Not be burdened by the past?
Oh, that's right out of Marx.
Of course not. Yeah, exactly. It's out of Marx. Exactly. We have to hide all this stuff, Suzette. We can't be talking about this kind of, we can't be talking that Thomas Jefferson spearheaded the whole abolition movement in that regard at the House of Burgesses. We can't be talking like that.
He never stopped talking about it.
Yeah.
Anybody that would listen throughout his entire career, his life, he addressed this. So he was
the more I hear this, the more frustrated I get. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
So in Shadwell burns to the ground. Okay, his library is lost. The only thing he loved more than music were books, and his library was lost. And he decided that he was going to build Monticello, and Monticello means little mountain in Italian. And so he found a high place about 2 miles from Chadwell, and he designed Monticello. That architecture was not a career. Just wasn't. Mm-hmm. But he designed Monticello, and a little room was completed in 1770, and he moved his books in. And at that time, he was still a bachelor. By the end of the year, he had started courting Martha. And Martha, again, her family was very wealthy. And they called her Patsy. I don't ask me why. Her name was Martha Wales Skelton.
You sure it wasn't Martha Washington? You sure he didn't kind of have, you know?
No, okay. It wasn't.
Okay, I'm just checking.
But she was known as Patsy, so I'm going to call her Patsy.
Her Patsy. Okay, that's good.
She was a beautiful musician. She was a beautiful woman, very distinctive, very feminine, very opinionated, very well-read. She would argue with him. They had great arguments about and discussions.
Sounds like you.
Oh, thank you. She was pretty amazing. And she had been married before, but she was widowed. So Thomas Jefferson knew her because she had been married to a classmate of his, an acquaintance. She was 22, very bright, very well-read, an accomplished harpsichord player, had studied music with the same Italian master that Jefferson had studied with. And she, you know, he was 6'2". She was tiny. So he looked like a giant next to her.
By the way, 6'2 is tall for that time.
Yes.
Yeah, my brother, God rest his soul, he bought a house in New Britain, Connecticut, that was built in the 17th, second oldest house in New Britain. I think the vintage was like 1750. And when you walk through that house, okay, and even when you walked up the stairs, and I'm only 5'10". When you walked up the stairs, my head almost hit the ceiling. Okay. So 6'2 at that time was huge. Because yep. your average man probably was only 5'7", 5'8", I'm yep. guessing, right? It's unbelievable how that house, when you walk through, saying, oh my God, people were small back then.
They yeah. were. Yeah. So he really stood out, he and Washington, you know, because they yeah. were very, you know, tall.
Big stature. Yeah.
Strong men, you know. And so Patsy, he brings Patsy to Monticello. And I guess they were married on January 1st, 1772. And the next 15 months were the happiest of his life. I mean, they had an amazing time together. 10 months later, Patsy has their first daughter. Things start going south in the spring. Martha's brother dies. So Patsy's brother dies. Mm-hmm. And followed by the death of her father a few months later. And Beth, I think I mentioned this earlier, people tended to die very quickly. There weren't many interventions, so people yeah. didn't linger. Yeah. They tended to get sick and die. Mm-hmm. His mother died in an hour. She was 57 years old, Jefferson's mother. When she passed away, and they thought she had a stroke. That's how it was described. So they weren't really sure why he died because of the limited medical knowledge during that time. But Jefferson took in, you know, Patsy's sister-in-law and her children. And he inherited Patsy's father's plantation
yep.
with the slaves. And the debt. People tend to think about the hegemony, I guess, of the eldest male inherits everything and nobody else gets anything. What they often fail to realize is he also inherits the debt. So it's not always just, you know, having it be easy. Now, I'm going to introduce a name to you. With Patsy coming to Monticello as Thomas's bride, she brought her slave with her, and her slave's name was Sally. And Sally was 9 years old at that time, and she looked just like Patsy. A 9-year-old Patsy.
Okay.
Now, it turns out that Mr. Wales, Patsy's father, had 10 children with one of his slaves. And Sally Hemings, her mother, Mrs. Hemings, was Sally's mother. And she comes to Monticello. And I'm just
going to So Sally Hemings was Patsy's sister. That's what you're saying.
Half-sister, yep.
Half-sister. Wow.
Never acknowledged publicly. Now, what they had going on privately, we don't know. We know all the slaves knew. I mean, this was not like, this was like one of those like unspoken things. We don't know what Patsy and Sally talked about. But they were, but that's how Sally comes into the picture. So Jefferson is, so let's move into, Jefferson's at the House of Burgesses and in attendance there when the Boston Tea Party happens. And they receive news while they're in session with the royal governor appointed by the king. And they receive this news and the entire House of Burgesses erupts in enthusiastic applause, shouts of joy. Go get them, you know. And the governor flips. And he immediately, this is treason. This is what you call treason back then. And he dissolves the House of Burgesses. And so Jefferson, who is a much stronger writer than he is speaker, writes a letter to the other colonies and tells them what's happening and says, you know, we should really have meet for a Continental Congress. We should send our people. All of us should come get together and meet. Let's pick a neutral place, Philadelphia. It's halfway. And we'll meet there. And they have their, that's how the Continental Congress gets started.
Really? Okay. And is that why they picked Philadelphia? Or just a it's a convenient location?
I think so. I think it was just, you know, it was a great city. There were a lot of people around there. There were some good, you know, it was kind of easy for everybody to get there.
Sure.
So he drafted the Virginia delegation for the Virginia delegation, a paper resolution saying this is what we should be, these are good things to focus on while you're in Philadelphia. Well, it turned out that one of the people that was going to go there couldn't, and he went in his stead. So he actually attended that first meeting and he had these resolutions and everyone was impressed. You know, people were like, wow, this is really something. Now, at this point, no one's talking out loud about independence. And when he brings it up, George Washington basically says, we're not talking about that. You know, we are not seeking independence. We're seeking, have you ever heard representation? Mm-hmm. We would like to have representation since we're being taxed. We're being taxed more than some of the people in England, and we have no representation in Parliament. This is what they were pushing for. They wanted representation, and they felt like because they were being taxed and not being represented, they were being undermined, and they were right. So he continued to... everything he wrote would really get circulated in pamphlets. That's how they did it back then. And that was one of the things about the Stamp Act. They made it so that a lot of things that went out, every piece of paper would have a tax on it. And, you know, this was horrifying because this was the only way you had to really communicate with other people. So pamphlets, of Jefferson's proposed resolutions were widely distributed throughout all the colonies. Militias were forming. First thing people did, because they knew the redcoats would come for them eventually.
What timing are we talking about here? What year is this?
This is the fall of 1774 is when they had the first Continental Congress.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
So we're in, it's the autumn.
And for those of you in Rio Linda, the declaration was signed on July 4th, 1776. I'm sorry, I couldn't help but bring Rush Limbaugh into this. I almost think Rush Limbaugh would have been a founding father if he lived back then. But anyway, go ahead. So a couple years later, okay, fine.
So a couple years later, they come together. Again, they come in the June of 75. So 1775, they have the Second Continental Congress meets.
Yep.
And at this point, this is a guy who spent most of time at home alone studying. The first time he ever had any kind of social life, like regular social life, being around a lot of people, was when he went to college, right? And he was in Williamsburg. It was a city of 1,000 people. This was like, so his circle of friends is very, very small. And he gets to Philadelphia, and because he circulated all these pamphlets or those have, you know, these, his ideas are being circulated, he's very popular. A lot of people know and like him, and he's, this is kind of mind-blowing for him. So he is, let's see, he meets Benjamin Franklin there. He met the radical John Adams, who agreed with Jefferson on liberty. Now, Adams ends up being a Federalist, which is what we would call the deep state or the administrative state. He really thought that government. Jefferson, of course, was a classical liberal. He did not believe that. You know, he knew that was not that would breed despots. And it has. We see that all the time. So back to his personal life. Between sessions in Congress, he returned to Monticello, and the war is now going on. You know, the first Concord and Lexington has happened, and he's in Congress and he's trying to help get money and organize things. And he goes home. His mother has passed away. His wife is very sick. Patsy had difficulty giving birth. She had six pregnancies and only two children survived, two daughters, Polly, and I can't think of her the other daughter's name. But the two girls survive, but Patsy is just getting sicker and sicker and sicker, you know, weaker. She's very frail. And after the last pregnancy, she passes away. I think she was in bed for about 2 months, very ill. And he's heartbroken. I mean, he's totally in love with her. And she's 32 years old. You know, she's young, and he's just devastated. And she dies. Sally is there, her maid, and some of the other housemaids are with her, and Thomas is with her. And he's distraught, and she makes him promise to never remarry. Now, I'm not, yeah, this was, this is so, it's a classic kind of thing, but it's, there's a lot of oral history to support that.
Now,
and he
again,
doesn't.
I want to make sure when you say she, you're talking about Sally, right?
Well, no, Patsy, his dying.
Oh, Patsy. Okay.
Patsy's dying. She's had her, you know, they've been
so,
married.
So Patsy, his wife, made him promise not to remarry.
Do not remarry.
Got it.
Promise
Okay.
me
okay.
You won't remarry. And he promises her that.
Mm-hmm.
And he spends some time at Monticello after that. He's a total mess. And he ends up getting called back to Washington, to Philadelphia.
To Philadelphia,
to the Continental Congress. And during the that session of the Continental Congress, Jefferson is included in a committee to write a Declaration of Independence. Everyone agrees it's time. And it's between John Adams. They want John Adams and Thomas Jefferson to write this. And John Adams is like, there is no way I can do this. This is something you have to do, Jefferson. He was kind of thinking, are they dumping this on me because I'm the youngest guy here? I mean, this is like a monumental task, right? And Adams insists, and he says, reason first, you're a Virginian. Biggest colony, most people, you should be writing this. Reason two, I'm obnoxious and unpopular, and you're quite the opposite. Everybody loves you. And reason three, you can write 10 times better than me and essentially anyone else here. So you're the guy to do this. And he goes in his grief to his little room in Philadelphia, and he pins the Declaration of Independence. And he brings it back. And of course, included in it, you guessed it, is to abolish slavery. And they have to get all 13 colonies, 57 people there, they have to gain consensus. And a lot of people own slaves, and not just the house slave that they could free and then hire somebody or start paying her, right? So it's not one person that you're, you know, in some cases, it's like you had to pay for the livelihood of 100 people and their families. So it was, this was like a bone of contention, and they take it out. You know, they edit it right out. And there were some other things that he wanted that they edited out. But he did at least get the, you know, what we have. So he accepted that. He understood that he needed that consensus. So while liberty had been theorized by philosophers and politicians over the years, no declaration had ever been created to separate people from sovereign monarch. So this is a first in the history of the world.
Yep.
in purposing American independence, in proposing, excuse me, American independence, Jefferson later wrote, "I sought to place before mankind the common sense of the subjects, plain and firm, as to command their assent. Revisions were made, but all considered this is his document." So he wrote something that everyone could understand. He didn't write it in Latin. He didn't use big words. He wrote very basic,
It's one of the most remarkable pieces of literature. And I'm not a literature guy, okay? I mean, I can't, but...
Me neither, you
people
know?
People more learned than me have talked about the Declaration equal on par with a Shakespearean type of writing. The writing was so eloquent, and his use of the English language and how he said things and how powerful every single word, there's no wasted words in it, but it was a powerful... It didn't only convey facts and demographic type data. It conveyed feelings. It conveyed sentiments. It was just remarkable, you know. And you know, one of the things many may not know is that God is referred to four times in the Declaration, and three of those times, he's referred to as the judge, the legislator, the person who writes laws, and the executor. Oh, yeah, guess what? That's where the three branches of government came from.
Okay. Exactly. The separation of powers was critical.
The separation of powers, because he knew, they all knew, I believe. I can remember all these people were pretty heavily Christian people here. Although, you know, I don't know if you'll talk about it, but Jefferson was a deist, but he believed in God, but he didn't believe in the future of mankind being controlled by God.
He thought it was controlled by our reason, and he makes an argument for that. And I have to say, as a Christian, I believe that too.
Well, yeah, you know, and it's funny you say that, because, you know, so many I've heard say, "Oh, he was an atheist. He didn't believe in God." That's not what a deist
not
is.
True.
That's not true at all. You know, and so anyway, he knew though that God could be the only one that can conduct those three, you know, that turned out into the three branches of government. He knew mankind could not, okay? And because we're corrupt, because of all the different, you know, things that he studied throughout the history with all these different civilizations that just demolished under a democracy, right? And they all knew that. So for the most part, they're all on the same page as far as being a republic versus a democracy. But he knew that the three branches were necessary to hold the checks and balances in place for this experiment to survive. Because it was the first one like it ever in the history of the world.
It was. And we have him to thank for it. Now, when you educate someone the way that he was educated in the Greek, in the Latin, in French, and they're learning all these different things. I mean, we don't even know what kind of Asian influence he had or if he did have it. But you start to understand. This is what he said about that. "It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no God at all."
I love it.
Now, he's not saying, "I don't believe there are 20 gods." He's not saying, "I don't believe there's no God." He's saying, "It doesn't hurt me if you believe that." You know,
but look at how he said that, Suzette. "It does me no injury." Who talks like that? That is brilliant.
"It does me no injury if you believe in 20 gods and or you believe in no gods." That was his
position. I would write this. I would say, "I don't care if you believe in 20 gods or no God." That's a lot different than what he said. "It does me no injury." That's a lot more powerful. Think about that.
Yes. It makes the point. Like, why would you respond, you know, violently to this statement? And they did. His political enemies used this statement to brand him an atheist. And an atheist is someone who believes no God exists. And that's never what he said.
It's still going on today. It's still going on today.
Yeah. I believe he was Christian, but also believed that he believed in self-determination.
That's
And a
right.
lot of people, you know, will say, oh, it's all up to God. It's all up to God. Well, God gave us brains. He gave us will.
Not everybody, by the way. Not everybody. There's a lot of people I know that don't have brains. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist. I had to say that.
So he said, so he said this whole, like, he really believed in the separation of church and state. Now, this is something we'll talk about more. But, and this is why the Church of England, the Anglican Church at the time, that was the frame of reference. It was a government church. It was supported by the government. You had to pay a tax to the Church of England.
Yeah, they were one of the same, right? They're basically one of the same.
Oh, yeah. So the people in these colonies were paying taxes to the Anglican Church in England. And as a matter of fact, it was kind of like, so he said it was the toughest battle of his life. The aristocrats of Virginia believed that church and state were synonymous. They were established figures, and they were all established figures in the Anglican church. My farm, my family, my books. That's what he, like, really cared about. You know, he was not, he kept his religious beliefs private. He acknowledged a benign creator, and while skeptical of Christ as the Son of God, he had a profound belief in Christ as the moral philosopher, which, and he probably did more for Christianity with that than anyone in the world. I mean, besides Christ, the one, to him, philosophers were the real heroes of civilization. In 1782, shortly before the end of the war, this is the Revolutionary War, Patsy gave birth. We talked about Patsy, but she gave birth when she did die. That last birth was a live child. So he did get to have that baby. He burned every letter they had ever shared.
Wow.
That's how distraught he was, that he could not have any mementos of her. He kept, like, had a little box in his desk, a lock of her hair and a few trinkets, but otherwise he just couldn't bear it.
That's a shame. It's too bad he did that.
Yeah, it was. I know. We do have love letters that he wrote to a woman, Maria Coswell, that he met in Paris, that are beautiful. They're called Head and Heart. And where he talks about, you know, his head telling him one thing and his heart telling him something else. It's a beautiful letter. You guys should look it up if you have a romance, if you're romantic at all, especially around Valentine's. So the war's over and independence has been gained, but Patsy was dead. In 1784, Jefferson went to France as a diplomat. As the U.S. minister. I think he replaced Benjamin Franklin there, as I recall. It was either he replaced Benjamin Franklin or John Adams. I'm not sure which. But he did find respite in France. I mean, it was the culture, the food, the theater, the music, the people. I mean, he was just totally blown away by this cosmopolitan Parisian city. This little kid, well, he's in his 30s, this young man from Virginia. And he is there, I believe he's there for quite a while. He was told, and he met this woman, Maria Conway, a beautiful musician and artist, and she was his companion there. She was married very unhappily, but somehow they managed to... They were together for years in there.
Okay.
So he's in Paris and he's met this wonderful woman. He really falls for her. They write each other letters, and we have those letters. They're actually at Monticello. And it becomes very clear that, you know, she's not going to get divorced. She's married. He goes back to the States, and he And I want to leave it there because he ends up back in Paris. He continues to do, this is a man who didn't seem to ever really take a break. So he's always doing big things. And we're going to talk about those in future episodes. We want to talk about the legislation that he proposed, his presidency, his governorships when he was Secretary of State under President Washington, you know, all of the important things that Jefferson did for us and the world.
You know, by the way, also, I think we need to touch on, I'm sure you will, in one of the, we'll probably do a couple more episodes on him, I got to believe. So we'll call this Thomas Jefferson Part One. But, you know, Jefferson, also the rift he had between he and Adams, that's also a real big deal we need to talk about, and how that all, and how they both died on the exact same day, on July 4th, 1826. They both died on the same day. Isn't that crazy? On July 4th of all days, right? But Suzette, so we're going to do some more on him because he's such an interesting guy. You know, as I was putting together the notes for Ben Franklin, I feel almost like I need to do that too because there's so much about him. But we'll see how that goes. Yeah.
Because these are like powerful guys that have influenced us. Think of why we think the way we think.
My God,
I didn't come up with these ideas, but when I read them, they resonated with me. I saw the truth. So,
a couple of things I want to talk about, and we can close on this, okay? Both Jefferson, Adams, and Ben Franklin were charged with putting together the seal for the United States. Okay. Mm-hmm. I can't remember how that all worked out, but one of the things that Jefferson wanted to put in the seal, okay, and I'm looking for it right now, if you bear with me, is refer to God, okay, which is kind of interesting because it's like, oh, wait a minute, he was an atheist, the liberals tell me, okay, and no, he wasn't an atheist. And I just look at this and just say, you know, well, geez, you know, he was a guy who here it is. He wanted to put in rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. He wanted that to be added to the seal. Now, I'm not sure it did get in, but that's something. And he clearly believed that while the government couldn't pass laws to establish a national church, individuals, even in government, were allowed to express their personal religious convictions. That's what gets missed. You can pray in Congress. You can pray in City Hall. You can pray in a public classroom. Now, let's just talk about this church and state business.
Yes.
Because church and state, first of all, is not in the Constitution. Nowhere is that language to be found, ever.
Right.
Now, when you look at the where it came from, the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut, the state that I'm from, were afraid that the state constitution of Connecticut did not have a protection clause in their constitution to prevent the state from intervening in their religion, because the Baptists were the minority and they were not liked and all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson wrote them a letter and said, now this is the Baptists of Danbury, Connecticut. And he cited the Supremacy Clause, which basically says in the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause says that the federal law is the law of the land, and a state cannot overwrite that. So mm-hmm. you need not be worried about the state of Connecticut trying to zap out your religion because the federal law is protecting you. That was what that was all about, okay? So he did use the word separation of church and state, but he didn't mean that...
no God in the state. He meant no God taxes. In state.
That's right.
That citizens... Right. Did not have to pay taxes to a government-sponsored church.
And a government can't establish a religion or prevent one.
I'm sorry?
The government cannot establish a religion and it cannot prevent a religion. Okay. That's the yeah. First Amendment. Now, in
and they can't make you
1947,
go to church. You had to go to the Anglican church. It was a
right.
sacrilege. You weren't getting anywhere anytime soon unless you were part of the Anglican church. That's how it was.
Well, Justice Hugo Black in 1947 wrote the majority opinion and defined the First Amendment religious clause in terms of a wall of separation between church and state. He struck down school prayer in 1947. It was the first Supreme Court case incorporating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment as binding upon the states. Okay, so now this is where this business about separation of church and state came from, that Supreme Court ruling. Now, who is this guy, Hugo Black? Justice Black was a member of the KKK, an organization that was known particularly bigoted towards Christians and especially Catholics, okay? And that's who this guy was, okay? So what happens is, if you go back to, let's look at the bigger picture here. You go back to the Communist Manifesto. Why are all communists atheists? They don't want you to pray to a god. They want you to pray and be beholden to the state. This all
exactly.
ties together, you see? Okay, so this whole business about church and state is a bunch of garbage, okay? And it's so misconstrued, like so many other things that you talked about today. Jefferson was a slave owner. He was against slavery. We didn't learn that in school. We didn't learn any of that stuff.
Oh, no,
okay?
We heard he was a hypocrite because he owned slaves, and then he says all men are created equal.
Matter of fact, most of these kids coming out of school today think that we, the United States, invented slavery. I mean, let's just forget about the past. Let's just forget
yeah.
about, let's not be burdened by the past, as Kamala says. Of course not, because it ruins your narrative, you know. Anyway, I just try to clear that up as far as the church and state thing. But so there's a lot to talk about here. So we're gonna get back on a couple more episodes on TJ.
Yay.
And
I love the guy. I mean, he's just like,
he's a stud.
Everything I've ever read about him, I liked, and so I'm very excited to continue the conversation. Next time we're going to talk more about, we'll just continue on. I mean, mm-hmm. The man lived a long time and he worked until he died. So we have a lot to talk about that he did, in the next part of his life.
Can't believe how much they accomplished in their lives. And when we talk about Ben Franklin, you're going to find that I'll never want you to tell me ever you have no time for anything based on what
hear
Ben
me
did.
say that.
No, I know you're always busy. But okay, kiddo, that was great. Okay, this was episode, what did I say it was? 35, I believe.
I believe so, yes.
Yep, 35. And it's TJ1. We'll call that Thomas Jefferson 1.
Yep.
That's really what we're talking about here. And 35. So we'll see you all next time on the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God, for Suzette Lawrence and Mark DeLuzio. Thanks, Suzette.
Thank you, Mark. And thank everyone for listening. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God, where we hold that strict adherence to the Constitution is the solution to most of our country's problems.
You can find other episodes on our website at 1787solution.com, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and most other platforms. We're your hosts, Mark DeLuzio and Suzette Lawrence. Until next time, may God bless you and may God bless America.